Okay, let us go ahead and get started. We will now continue with our larger comparative discussion as we turn to Greece, then Greece and Rome, and then finally a few theoretical discussions. It is therefore my tremendous honor to begin the session by introducing Cleo Carastro, who will be discussing When Ritual is a Critical Thinking, Writing and Divination in Ancient Greece. Please join me in giving our very warmest welcome to Cleo Carastro. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. I would like to thank warmly Anne Chang and Stéphane Feuillas for inviting me to this wonderful conference with prestigious sinologists and other colleagues I know personally or by name. I've learned a lot since yesterday morning, and I found crucial points for general discussion. I'm persuaded that the comparative perspective is vital for our common thinking. But this is also a challenge after Sharman Amood, for instance, and I hope to offer a very modest contribution to it. The narrative is very well known. At the beginning of the 5th century BC, the Persian Wars opposed a large empire of Asia Minor and very small Greek city-states. In 480, the Persians and their allies were at the doors of Athens. Thousands of soldiers were ready to destroy the Greek city. In this emergency situation, the assembly decided to send two ambassadors to the sanctuary of Delphi in order to ask the oracle for a solution of salvation. After the first ritual of consultation, which was unproductive, the second oracle gave some hope to the Athenian messengers, who wrote down the response to bring it back to Athens. Consulting oracular powers was quite a common practice in the daily life of ancient Greek communities. Delphi is very well known from literary sources, but another famous sanctuary, the one of Zeus of Dodona, deserves to be cited, since thousands of inscribed lead tablets have been unearthed from its archaeological site, spanning from the 5th century BCE to the 2nd century of the Common Era. Even though other oracular sanctuaries were spread around the Greek world, I propose to focus on the use of writing in Delphi and Dodona, which both testify about a very common practice for cities and individuals to ask the oracle for solving general or particular problems. Despite this fact, the consultation of the Delphic oracle by the Athenians in 480 and the great amount of lead tablets from Dodona, you have some examples here, so they were very tiny tablets, rectangular ones, 10 centimeters per 5, folded, sometimes rolled up, inscribed with names, questions to the oracle, and sometimes with some answers. So, despite this fact, the consultation of the Delphic oracle by the Athenians in 480 and the great amount of lead tablets from Dodona are rarely compared. The reason is quite simple. Delphi is the sanctuary where the oracular response was given by the Pythia, a woman who was inspired by the god Apollo. In other words, Delphi is the place par excellence where oral divination, was practiced. On the other side, Dodona is well known for various techniques of divination, even though inscriptions on lead tablets are the most massive corpus we have from Greek antiquity. At a closer glance, even Delphi knew different divinatory techniques, but if we consider it in the long durée. But let's focus for the moment on the great divide between oral and written divination. In contrast with ancient Chinese and Mesopotamian divination, ancient Greek mantic practices have been often thought as oral. Focusing on literary sources about inspiration at Delphi, historians have neglected the role of writing in ancient Greece. Even though the publication of the epigraphical material from Dodona has taken many decades, it is less a question of evidences, I mean literary versus epigraphical, than a question of ideological choices. Oral divination is still considered as a noble way to have access to divine knowledge, which echoed the prophetic knowledge in ancient Jewish tradition. Whereas written mantic divination is supposed to belong to a more technical practice, which means less intellectual and less valuable, theologically speaking. Instead of subscribing to this hierarchy between oral and written techniques, which only partially depends on ancient texts and reflects the bias of polemical debates of the first Christian authors, I prefer to analyze all these practices as equally valuable, and I suggest to dismiss the idea that writing was a marginal practice in Greek divination, in order to understand how rituals in ancient Greece, and especially mantic rituals involving writing, coped with the construction of a specific space where human and non-human agency could be combined. A space where sometimes critique could be expressed. Indeed, focusing on the role of writing in mantic practices is crucial for me to grasp how critical thinking can be embedded in ritual. The point I would like to raise today is that ritual action is conceivable as a mode of exercising critical thinking. As a matter of consequence, ritual writing in ancient Greek mantic procedures, shouldn't be analyzed neither as a script of anxieties nor as a simple recording of an oral performance, but as the expression of a performative and sometimes critical thinking. As for the theme of canonization that Anne and Stéphane invited you to focus on, I will stress the point that for ancient Greece there is not such a comparable textual production on ritual matters like in ancient Indian or Chinese traditions. Although we could look for some forms of canonization of ritual in a specific category of inscriptions, recent scholarship has focused on the normativity and regulations, and I guess that Vinciane and John will give an account of it in their presentation. My interest is more in what seems to be the opposite of canonization and tradition, I mean critique. So let's have a few minutes on ritual. Anthropologists and historians of religion presume to know what a ritual is and is not. But the effort of finding a consensus is often hopeless, and doubts have been often expressed on the possibility to elaborate a comprehensive theory of ritual. This is why I propose to consider the term ritual as a problem word rather than a tool word. A problem word is a tool word about which we start thinking. It will be a concept rather than a simple object. And as a concept, it deserves to be submitted to the analysis from multiple theoretical perspectives. Being careful to distinguish indigenous and disciplinary definitions and categories. I'm a kinetic. The question of efficiency is often invoked, but a special attention has to be paid to the risks of the temptation to understand efficiency in the sense of a sort of mechanical result. Because the mechanicity is a leitmotif of the critique, the Christian fathers moved against pagan cults. The supposed mechanicity of the ritual was stigmatized by the word magic, for instance, which is another sticky tool word we need to constantly problematize. The question of meaning and of symbolic meaning has often been crucial for scholars working within the theoretical horizon whose matrix is clearly Judeo-Christian. But what happens if actors claim, like in Jaini contest, that ritual is meaningless? An important recent issue has been found by anthropologists of religion focusing on ritual as a quality of action and not as a class of events or institution. Then new questions arise, and a theory of ritual becomes an account of the transformation of action by ritualization. A major distinction between ritual action and other human actions, since ritualized acts are stipulated in a peculiar way, is then possible. Acts present themselves to individual actors as given and external to themselves. This is why actors are and are not the authors of their acts. I will argue that this is in and by this transformation that there is room for critics and critique. In this framework, critique will proceed not necessarily from an individual, from the intention of an individual, but from gestures and inflections. Thus, would it be possible to think about ritual as a critical thinking? In this sentence, if this sentence sounds like an oxymoron, this is because of the common dichotomy between action and thought. Ritual think a ritual being always conceived. Ritual being always conceived as fitting in the first. I will instead understand ritual not as a mechanical gesture, but as an intentionally directed act, which has its own dynamics, thanks to the tension between an action here and now from one side and an external dimension, which is invisible, far in time, and that can be a source of authority. It will be difficult to speak about rituals without taking into consideration actors and their objects. And since rituals can produce material objects or call upon material support, I like to stress the notion of chaîne opératoire, operational sequences or sequences of gestures, in order to remind how artifacts can be concretions not only of manual gestures, but also the result of thinking through gestures. This is why I propose to say that doing is thinking. The point is then to understand how thinking ritual can be critical and how critique has to be freed from common ideas based on the great divide between modern and other societies. We often have to face a very established dichotomy between societies where tradition will be a heritage, even though recently constructed, and societies where the concept of tradition can be put into question, where the use of writing and criticism will be a distinctive sign. In the latter, culture will consist on the critical judgment, philosophy, historiography, science, and religious movements develop. This would perfectly fit with the idea we have of the so-called Greek Enlightenment of the 5th century BCE, which still haunts our field. But if we dismiss this dichotomy too, and pay attention to the way even the most traditional traditions, such as myth and ritual, carry the traces of cultural reflexivity, the living traces of the play with the values and norms, we could better understand how through myth and ritual, like through history, tradition can be done and undone, can be questioned as a matter of judgment, as a matter of choice. To clarify this statement, I will take a famous passage from Sophocles' play Antigone, represented in Athens in 442 BCE. The plot is built on the opposition between Creon, the king of Thebes, who decided to forbid to give funeral rituals to Polynices, one of his nephews, who died attacking the city of Thebes, and Antigone. Antigone was the sister of Polynices, who decided not to follow the law of Creon, the law of the king. She then offered customary honors to the corpse of her brother by a minimal form of funeral rituals, pouring a tiny layer of dust on it. Modern interpretations are indebted to with Hegel's reading of the passage in his Lessons for a Philosopher of Religion. The struggle between Creon and Antigone would be representative of the birth of the modern state, where written law, guaranteed by a central and non-religious power, can overcome lineage strategies and customs. We could say that this interpretation, which is echoed by modern philosophy of politics, is not consistent with the reading of the text we can do from an anthropological point of view that focuses on polytheistic logic. Let's have a look to Sophocles' text. When Creon asks how Antigone dares to overstep the law, he used the term nomos, as you can see. Antigone, she answers, saying that she's following another nomos, which is the nomos unwritten, given by the gods. The strong conflict between the two is characterized by the peculiar stress on the same word nomos, which is normally translated by law, custom, then culture, by opposition to physis, nature, but which could also be translated sometimes by rituals. The conflict between these two nomoi seems to be echoed by what Michael Puette wrote in his article on rituals and the subjunctive about the difference between Chinese and rabbinic traditions. Creon would be the voice of the rational city, whereas Antigone, like Rabbi Nathan, was a practitioner of the ritual and then too much embedded in the practice in order to be able to put a distance between herself and her gesture. In this scene, the act of writing laws, will stand on the side of retrospective and reflexive gesture. It will be on the side of government, of the birth of modern state, in Hegel's perspective. But if you pay more attention to Antigone's gesture and to the way the corpse of her brother was preserved from corruption by the gods, like the corpse of Hector in the Homeric tradition, we can suppose that Sophocles was not a defendant of traditional rituals and customs against the new ideology of the city, but rather criticized the monopoly of writing in the city by a tyrant, which means by a specific group led by an individual who pretended to centralize power in his hands. Criticism by Sophocles, that would be comparable to that of Herodotus against tyrants, proceeds from the gesture done by Antigone of pouring some quantity of earth on her brother's corpse. A gesture signifying not only contestation, but also a critical thinking. Thus, another epistemological obstacle has to be removed as far as public writing is concerned. As a technology allowing publicity in the city, writing is also analyzed as a sign of reflexivity. To say it in a nutshell, ancient Greece had writing, so reflexivity. This assumption is largely shared, above all, when we think of ancient historiography, philosophy, medicine, and poetry. But we should pay attention to the tricky consequence of it, because the next step is to assume that critics and reflexivity is only on the side of historical or philosophical writings, and that, on the other side of the spectrum, ritual writing will be confined within the enclosure of efficient acts. Ritual writing would only be a performative way to cope with risk, uncertainty, or to create an illusion to modify our future. In other words, the risk will be to say they believe that, and then, but we as modern, we know that. This will be the illusion of to be modern, would say Latour. Let's come back to ancient Greece and let's say that first, writing publicity is not the prerogative of central power. And then, ritual writing is not just a recording of oral performances. And let's turn to Herodotus' text on the consultation of Delphi in 480. To do so, I claim that ritual cannot be understood in the way Lévi-Strauss conceived it in the famous finale of L'Homme Nu. We know how myth and mythical thinking was the main field of inquiries of the great anthropologist. In the finale, he presented ritual as the opposite of myth. If myth is a place where thinking creates discontinuities, ritual would be the activity trying to create continuities, a continuity by repetition, creating again order. But Lévi-Strauss said desperately, because continuity is a fiction, ritual tries to settle, but myth unsettle. So I will say that ritual is also a place where you can create discontinuity and debate. So when we analyze ritual, we have to enlarge the chronological spectrum and not to focus only on gestures. Ritual goes on with commentaries, even many years later. Time is to conclude with a very well-known case of the Athenians I presented at the beginning. As we saw, the Athenians asked, the Theoroi asked twice the oracle a response. And the second time, they decided to write down, the verb is syngraphein, to write down, which doesn't mean to register, to record. It means to establish a contract between the oracular power, giving the oracle, the Theoroi, collecting it, and then, last step, the assembly, where the oracular response is discussed, because the oracular is, as always, never clear, and it needs to be interpreted. But this interpretation has to be done within the assembly. So when we try to understand how writing functions, we have to understand that writing starts from the moment there is the consultation and arrives within the space of the assembly. To conclude, can writing gesture be critical? In his famous painting, Apollo and the Artist, Cy Twombly answers yes. Writing acquires all his body, becoming a palpable gesture. By the thickness of the line and by colors, the painter is willing to give a graphic existence to writing as a critical gesture. Names are not only tags. They come into existence by drawings. The battlefield of the Iliad is there. Apollo enters into it by the power and strength of his divine body. The name becomes a body, like any other. A tension, even a struggle, seems to be at work between the painter and the painting. The struggle, the critique, was identified by the Circle of Vienna as a prerogative of literature. As long as we assume that only the philosopher can produce criticism in the view of truth, we risk to lose the power of gesture that the artist and the artifacts bring together. Yes, the poet too can produce critique. If it in the vein of Hölderlin and pre-Hegelian philosophical tradition, suggestions have been made that the Homeric poems were critical acts, I would ask, what if is a poem is not a critique made by ritual means? The same, I would claim, can be said for ritual writings in ancient Greece. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.